Welcome to the Rockford Symphony Podcast. This is Margot Stedman, Education and Community Engagement Director, and today you will hear a live session recorded at the University Club of Rockford on February 18th, 2020, as Music Director Stephen Larson reveals the 2021 season. We'll now join Executive Director Julie Thomas as she introduces the host for this session, John Floater.
So it is my pleasure to introduce a staff member that maybe many of you have not met before. This is John Floater. John, I'm actually going to move and John will be here. But John is our personnel manager for the orchestra. And so what that is he makes sure that we have contracted all of our musicians. If there are substitutes needed, John is really the one that facilitates all of that happening so that we have a great group of musicians playing every concert. He also helps with some of our operations and production things and hospitality with our guest artists. So he wears a lot of behind-the-scenes hats that are really integral to making the orchestra and the concert experience possible. So it's my pleasure to introduce John. We are going to record this. Oh, it's already on. We are going to record this, and at some point it'll be part of our podcast series. So thank you so much for being here, and enjoy the discussion. There will be opportunities to ask questions as well. So welcome.
Thank you, Julie. So I'm going to begin by introducing Steve. So Steve, this is your 30th and final season with the Rockford Symphony, and this being your bucket list season, what made you decide what to pick for this season? And is this really what did you have in mind? Were these pieces you wanted to conduct, or were you thinking about are these pieces you'd like the players to play, or the audience to hear? And believe me, a lot of the people that have been in your audience and in your orchestra have been with you almost all of this time as well. So,
The answer is all of the above. Mm-hmm. The bucket list, if there was one, and actually there is one because I do have several sheets of paper. I've written down pieces that I must do before I retire, and most of them I will not do because, well, there just aren't enough concerts. And in some cases, I always really, really, really wanted to do Mahler's Third Symphony, maybe Mahler's Sixth or Mahler's Seventh before I retired. That's not going to happen. Bruckner also is not going to happen. There are a number of pieces that for various reasons just didn't make the list. There are pieces that I program because I really think the orchestra will enjoy playing them. And there are pieces that I program because I knew the audience would like them very much. And it kind of goes without saying, perhaps, but I guess I need to say it, is that almost anything I conduct, or I guess really any conductor, almost anything a conductor, any conductor conducts, you get into. I mean, you really become part of it, and you enjoy it, and it becomes important. You might not stick with you a month or two later or something, but at the time, it's a very important part of your life. So I feel that way about all these pieces.
Mm-hmm. Sometimes whatever you're playing that week is your favorite piece.
Yeah.
For that week.
Yeah.
This season has a lot of composers on it that a lot of audiences are familiar with, but you also put some pieces and composers on there that will be new to the audience and maybe some of the players. Let's start with Classics 1. Brahms, Bach, Dvorak are all composers that people are generally familiar with. But William Walton isn't a composer that we hear as much. And you're having an RSO favorite, Rachel Barton Pine, come to perform his violin concerto. Can you tell us a little bit about this concerto and your relationship with Rachel?
Well, neither of us have done this piece before, which is the reason we're doing it.
Okay.
The first time I conducted Rachel in a concert, I think she was 12.
Oh, really?
I conducted her when she was a couple years later, when she was 16, maybe even, I don't even remember now all the times, but shortly before she had, before her accident, just before the season before I started in Rockford, we did the Barber Violin Concerto. And since then, we've done pretty much all of the major concertos. either here or elsewhere together. And so for the last couple of times I've worked with her, it's always been, well, what do you want to do now? Mm-hmm. And Walton is a piece that that we neither of us have done, and we've always wanted to. It's a lovely piece, written in 1937, I think, for Yasha Heifetz. Mm-hmm. William Walton is a very highly regarded English composer. He's kind of faded a little bit out of public consciousness in the last several years. He wrote an oratorio called Belshazzar's Feast that used to be done all the time, mm-hmm. and for some reason has just kind of dropped off the face of the earth. But very, very talented composer. We've done a number of his works in the past, usually smaller pieces, but really like him, and so this is our chance to do this piece together for the first and the last time.
Very good. Well, but now Rachel does come from a big musical family. She's got plenty of siblings who play as well. Can you tell us who will be playing the Bach double violin concerto with Rachel?
Yes, her daughter Sylvia.
Wow. Cool.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness.
This is something when I asked Rachel to do the Walton, she said, would you be open to the idea of Sylvia and I playing the Bach double concerto? And I said, well, sure. But I'm not paying her anything. And she said, okay, that's fine. So anyway, she'll be, that's kind of a little extra perhaps for that concert. Opening Brahms Academic Festival Overture. I've always loved this piece. And it personifies Brahms' sense of humor and his little cheeky sense of humor. He wrote this when he was given an honorary doctorate degree. He decided to write it based on student drinking songs, which the administration was not very happy about, but he did it anyway. He's Johannes Brahms. He can do whatever he wanted to.
Also on the program is Dvorak.
Yes.
And so tell us a little bit about why you're programming that.
It seems like almost every time I program Brahms, I program Dvorak too, because I kind of think of them sort of as a unit. Dvorak was in some respects a protege of Brahms. Brahms furthered his career when he was young, when he was just getting started. Dvorak was very appreciative, and there's a kind of a common feeling between their music. But this piece in particular, Symphony No. 9, we haven't done for quite a number of years now. I think it's been about 15 since we've done the piece.
Oh.
And it's one that... It's one of the war horses, one of the most often played pieces, and been one of the most popular. I feel kind of a connection to the piece. I've done the piece in the Czech Republic with the Czech orchestra, and that was a real interesting experience.
Mm-hmm. Well, can you tell us a little bit about the experience of playing, conducting Czech music with Czech musicians, as opposed to...
Well, in a piece like this... The Czech orchestras that play concerts in Prague routinely have a list of some of the same pieces they do over and over again. They play a lot for tourists. And Dvorak 9 is one of them. The Moldau Vultava from Vlast is another one. And they tend to play these pieces very badly. I think so, anyway. Mm-hmm. Because they don't rehearse them. They just play them, and they all know them. And they think, well, we're the great authorities here because we're the Czechs. Well, he wrote it in this country, first of all, although that everybody claims to hear spirituals and folk tunes and American folk music in the piece, the Czechs claim, probably rightly, that there is just as much Czech folk music in
Absolutely,
there as there is
yeah.
American. But it was an interesting experience. It was not really adversarial, but I had to insist on some things and playing with them that they really didn't want to do because that's not the way they do them mm-hmm. all the time. It was fun. I think ultimately they enjoyed the experience I did too.
Sure. I'm sure it was very interesting. So moving ahead chronologically, we have the Pops 1 next. What do you have planned, and how are we opening the Pops series?
Well, we're doing the same thing we did last year because we had so much fun, and I think a lot of the audience had so much fun.
The proms.
The last night of the proms.
Yeah.
That we thought, we're going to do it again and see if we can make this a tradition and make it bigger and better and more outrageous. Were you anybody not there? You got to come back. It's just that my favorite memory of the concert was not something I experienced during the concert, but a video of my 22-year-old son, who was brought up in hip-hop for the most part, singing at the top of his lungs, "Rule Britannia, Britannia rules the waves."
Just that was everything.
Bellowing out, just having the greatest time. And the whole audience singing that too. It was just a lot of fun. So we're going to try to, we're just going to keep the British traditional aspect of the end of the concert, but also I view this concert as a little bit of going back to the old days of the Boston Pops concerts, where the Boston Pops concerts were essentially all the great light classics that, as to paraphrase Yogi Berra, nobody plays because they're too popular. Mm-hmm. So just chock full of pieces that are great light classical pieces that just never seem to find their way into programs anymore. Because they're not serious enough.
Well, this is another way to put them in there.
Yeah.
In a post-Brexit proms concert. All right, so 2020 is an anniversary year for Beethoven, and we'll be celebrating that on our Classics 2 program with the Nielsen Chorale. Tell us what you have planned for that program.
You know, how to celebrate perhaps the greatest composer, most famous composer in history's 250th birthday. What do you do? There's of course, well, it's going to have to be something orchestral. We're not going to be doing string quartets. Not going to be doing piano music. But so it's going to, out of his orchestral pieces, he wrote 9 of the greatest symphonies ever written. We can't do them all. We can't do anything really that represents his genius in any meaningful way. So pick a symphony. Well, it's November. That's traditionally when we do a concert with a chorale, with the Nielsen Chorale. We're doing Beethoven's 9th symphony, the Choral Symphony. But not just that. I thought we might as well pad the program a little bit more. We're doing the overtures. Overture to his opera, his only opera, Fidelio. He wrote four overtures to that opera before he finally decided on Fidelio, the final one. Mm-hmm. And then the Choral Fantasy, a piece from 1808, I think, that he wrote as a kind of a sketch in preparation for writing the finale to the 9th Symphony. He had the idea back then of writing a symphony with a choral ending, and he experimented a little bit with it with the orchestra chorus and the piano soloist in the Choral Fantasy. So we'll be doing that, kind of a short first half, taking a break and coming back and doing the 9th Symphony.
All right. That sounds good. The Holiday Pops, of course, is a holiday tradition in our community. Can you tell us anything about that?
Well, the Nielsen Chorale will be back again to sing. We don't have a major piece chosen yet. When I say we, I talk about it. This is my wife and I that decide this. But we've been talking about a couple of possibilities and how to make this concert special. We don't quite know exactly where it's going to go yet, but we'll probably feature them, again, on the second half. But the usual assortment. One of the great things about doing a programming the Holiday Pops concert is that there is almost an infinite variety, it seems, of arrangements of holiday tunes that you can find there. I wouldn't even want to guess how many different orchestral arrangements there are of Silent Night, for instance.
And some good ones, too.
And some very good ones, yeah. The Christmas music seems to bring out the best in arrangers, challenge them to make something new, make something fresh, and they generally do a good job. So this is always a fun concert to program. Mm-hmm. To go through the list of pieces we've done, to find new music that's been published just recently, new arrangers, and the occasional original piece, like last year we did Brother Heinrich's Carol.
Oh, that was good, yes, I remember that, yeah.
And there's there's a piece that along that line that may be coming up for this year, too. We'll mm-hmm. see how it all fits into the schedule.
Mm-hmm. Now, The Classics 3 concert series is going to be a matinee this year. And I think that was a consideration to try something new out about, especially in the winter months when it's dark, darker earlier and colder and harder to drive. So we're going to try something out with doing a matinee. But aside from the timing, what about the programming? On Classics 3, it has two composers people are probably familiar with, I'm sure. Wagner and Sibelius, and then a guy named Carlisle Floyd. So let's start with Floyd's Peace Pilgrimage. You're bringing back another RSO audience favorite with baritone Nick Yanitsky.
Nick Yanitsky.
Yeah. What's this piece like?
Carlisle Floyd is primarily known as an American opera composer. His two most famous works were Susanna, probably his best known for Susanna, which I've conducted, is really one of my favorite 20th century operas, and Of Mice and Men. Floyd wrote this piece in the 1955 for a very famous baritone, probably the most famous American bass baritone of the mid-20th century, Norman Traigle. And it's a solo cantata for voice based on biblical passages. And I first came across this piece in the 1970s. I thought it was absolutely gorgeous. It was just beautiful, particularly the ending. And I've always wanted to do it and never have quite found the right place for it, and I decided this is one of the pieces, this is a bucket list piece.
Okay.
Wanted to do this, I've got another chance to do it, so I think Nick's going to be just a fantastic voice for this. I think it's going to be a very powerful, very touching work.
Mm-hmm. What makes the Sibelius Symphony No. 1 a bucket list piece for you, and what should the audience be listening for?
When we did our trip to Tanglewood last summer, one of the pieces the Boston Symphony played was Sibelius' First Symphony. And I didn't say anything beforehand that I was planning on doing it, but afterwards, I think you can attest to this, a number of you said, wow, you got to do that piece. And I said, oh, okay, maybe I'll think about it. But it's a piece I haven't done before. I think it's a very, very powerful work. It's got a lot of raw power. People say about Sibelius that you can almost see the granite and the rocks and the pine trees and the snow and the ice. You can hear that in the music. It's a lot of fire and granite and ice and all together. It's just really a wonderful mixture of just everything that seems to be what being Finnish is all about. It's a great showpiece for the orchestra, too. It's as he got older, he became more and more cautious. This is my opinion, anyway. He became more and more cautious in terms of the orchestration. Mm-hmm. And at this point in his career, he was 33. He knew how to orchestrate very, very well, but he wasn't afraid to take some chances. Mm-hmm. So this wonderful opening with a solo, beautiful solo clarinet over the long timpani role that he never would have done later on in his life.
So he didn't back away from the challenge of giving some more challenging music for the musicians.
Yeah, it's I think a very, very powerful work and piece I've been putting off for a couple of years, and now it's time to do it.
Okay. You've got another challenging one on that same program, the Overture to the Flying Dutchman.
Yeah. Fairly early Wagner. But it's the first 30 seconds of the overture are maybe the best 30 seconds of any overture ever written.
The energy is there.
It just grabs you by the neck and just throws you around the room. It's just a great piece.
It's a fun ride.
Yeah.
Classics 4 takes place on February 13th, 2021, close to Valentine's Day, and it opens with a piece called Symphonic Chocolates by Maxime Goulet.
Yeah, you think there's any coincidence there?
What do you think?
This is definitely not a bucket list piece because I didn't come across this until, last fall. I just kind of happened to stumble across it. That Symphonic Chocolates, really? four movements. The first movement is called Caramel Chocolate. It's called Orchestral Suites in four movements. Suites.
Yeah, I get it. Clever.
Caramel Chocolate, Dark Chocolate, Mint Chocolate, and Coffee-Infused Chocolate. Maxime Goulet is a Canadian composer. I won't want to say it's not great music because I don't know. We're going to have to give it a little chance, but it certainly has a lot of immediate appeal. You listen to it and you can't help but smile.
Mm-hmm.
It's very, 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 it gives you a very immediate effect.
That sounds like a lot of fun. Then pianist Alon Goldstein is coming to play Schumann's Piano Concerto with the orchestra. Alon has joined the orchestra twice over the years and has been part of the composer festivals.
Three times.
Yes, okay,
three times previously.
My notes are wrong here.
Not your notes. When we talked about this earlier, we forgot. He also has done the second Liszt concerto with us,
mm-hmm.
As well as Brahms and Schumann and Beethoven, the Beethoven concertos, Beethoven Festival.
So he's got some history with us.
He does indeed.
So why was it special to have Alon come join us for your final season with this concerto?
He hasn't been here for a few years, and that's probably a good enough reason right now. He's just a brilliant, brilliant pianist. But also, when we did this, the Brahms Schumann Festival several years ago, he played the first movement of the Schumann Concerto. And I remember he did it brilliantly. And it's a piece that I've liked very much because this was a very important concerto in the mid 19th century. It seemed to break the mold of concertos that wanted to be very, very serious and very important. And instead, it was just brilliant music.
Mm-hmm.
The slapdash, wonderful, a first movement with lots of virtuosity in it, a perfectly lovely second movement, and a real romp for the third. It was a very influential in a lot of composers. Edvard Grieg wrote his piano concerto in imitation of the Schumann concerto.
Mm-hmm.
Several other composers are very, very strongly influenced by it. Schumann has also been a composer that, for whatever reason, has been very close to my heart. I recognize his flaws. His symphonies are all flawed, but they've always connected with me in a way that other composers just haven't. I just have this kind of a soft spot in my heart for Schumann. So I thought, what are we going to do the last year? Going to be a Rachmaninoff concerto? Going to be some of the big splashy? No, I want to do Schumann.
Now, how and why did you choose this particular Mozart symphony to include on this program?
Well, it was his last symphony. It's my last season.
Mm-hmm.
Also, in the last few years, we have done the 39th, 40th, and now the 41st symphony, the last three symphonies. These three works he wrote in the course of 6 weeks in 1788, and there's no proof that he ever heard this piece performed. There's no record. Public record of a performance.
These weren't commissions.
No, these weren't commissions, and this is completely unlike Mozart in that Mozart almost always wrote pieces for a particular purpose. Well, we assume he had a purpose for these three symphonies. They just never happened.
Mm-hmm.
Symphonies usually happen at concerts. He would produce himself for his own benefit, and one would have to think that he had planned some concerts with these symphonies. It was during the late spring, summer, and wherever he thought they were going to go, never happened.
Hmm.
So, and the last, the 41st symphony, so the so-called Jupiter symphony, it has some just astonishing passage work in there. The famous part is the coda of the last movement, which he breaks into a fugue. at the end. And those of you who have maybe studied music and have taken counterpoint, have labored through that of the learned art of combining melodies together, know that writing two-part counterpoint is difficult.
Yes.
particularly invertible counterpoint, where you can turn the melodies upside down, put one on top of the other, and they still work together without violating any rules. Two-part invertible counterpoint is difficult. Three-part is very, very difficult. Very, very, very difficult. Four-part invertible counterpoint is virtually impossible. And five-part invertible counterpoint, well, you have to go to the finale of the Jupiter Symphony.
That's right. The basses actually have an independent entrance in that fugue, and, which is a first.
And the average person listening to this thinks, well, that's all pretty cool. They have no idea.
Oh, there's difficult. There's actually a 12-tone aspect to that fugue as well.
Yeah.
I know Schoenberg has written something on that.
Yeah, right.
Well, so getting a little lighter than that, though, the next up is the classic Broadway program. What can we expect to hear on that program?
Rodgers and Hammerstein.
All right.
Rodgers and Hammerstein, writing in the 40s and 50s into the early 60s, really changed, revolutionized American musical theater. Before they came along, musical theater was pretty fluffy stuff. It was farces, light comedies, just full of silly songs and dances and just light entertainments. And Rodgers and Hammerstein came along and wrote musicals that addressed social issues, addressed real serious emotional struggles, and did it in a way that sort of rewrote, well, they in some ways they wrote the major part of the Great American Songbook, these great tunes from these musicals. Oklahoma opened in 1943 with the unprecedented gesture of somebody coming on stage and singing There's a Bright Golden Haze in the Meadow all by themselves, mm-hmm. no orchestra. Wow, what's happening here? In the course of their careers, they addressed domestic violence, racism, all sorts of different things in their musicals, and did it in a way that that in a way simplified the whole structure of the musical. The earlier the musicals of the 1930s tended to be rather very wordy. The songs were wordy, mm-hmm. and quite clever sometimes, but didn't quite have the ability to connect with people. Somehow, Rodgers and Hammerstein found that ability to write music that connected with people's hearts. And even Stephen Sondheim, probably the greatest musical composer of our time, said that he owes everything to Rodgers and Hammerstein. He wouldn't have been able to do what he does had they not been before him. So this concert's going to be with the primarily featuring the Nielsen Chorale with some solos and a number of orchestral pieces taken from their works.
Okay, that sounds like a good one. After opening with the Verdi overture La Forza del Destino on Classics 5, it's a program of variations. We have mm-hmm. Elgar's Enigma Variations. And cellist Alexander Hirsch is going to return and play the Tchaikovsky Variations on a Rococo theme. Mm-hmm. An interesting word to try to pronounce sometimes, Rococo. Tell us about that.
Well, do y'all remember Alexander Hirsch from the fall? You know, I don't usually bring back soloists the next year, but I thought he's got to come back. I've just never heard cello playing like that before. What a delightful young man, too. I don't think I ever remember seeing anybody play with that much joy as watching him play. So, you're right. There are variations involved in everything but the overture here. The first piece he's going to do is Kol Nidre by Max Bruch. We just did the Scottish Fantasy by Max Bruch. Kol Nidre was a piece he wrote for cello solo, it's based, what did he call this? Adagio, the other title is Adagio on Two Hebrew Melodies. And one of them is the Kol Nidre, the all vows that are traditionally part of the ancient synagogue service for Yom Kippur. The Bruch was not Jewish, he was Protestant, but he viewed these two tunes, which were brought to his attention by a Jewish friend, he viewed them as being much like he viewed the tunes in the Scottish fantasy. They were folk tunes. They were the genuine, according to him, the genuine expression of human feeling that comes out not out of the artifice of writing music, but out of the soul. And he wrote this for solo cello. It's these two themes and then variations on them. It's a beautiful, beautiful expressive piece for cello and orchestra. And the next set of variations is Tchaikovsky's Variations on a Rococo Theme. Tchaikovsky wrote this in 1877. Bruch wrote his in 1880. Did he know about this piece? I don't know.
I don't think so.
I don't know whether he did or not. I haven't been able to dig into it that much. But pieces for solo, cello, and orchestra were not all that common in the mid to late 19th century. There were some cello concertos, but it really wasn't until Dvorak came around that was sort of the first major, big cello concerto. The two pieces couldn't be more different in mood. The Tchaikovsky Rococo Variations is just very lighthearted and virtuosic and just fun to listen to and fun to play. Alexander just loves the idea of doing the contrast of these two pieces.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to working with him on those too. I mean, he was really great to work with before. And the energy he just brings to everything was just infectious. And then we close the pop series with a really fun program titled
the Elgar Variations.
The Elgar,
talk about that.
The Enigma Variations. Oh, yeah. Well, let's talk about those. Okay, before we even talk about the pops. Sorry about that.
All right. Well, this is This is kind of fits all of the three. The standards that you asked about at the beginning is something that I wanted the orchestra to play because, well, you've played, you love this piece.
Oh, I absolutely love to play the Enigma Variations.
The audience loves to hear it, and I love to conduct it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a threefer here.
We'll all have a good time.
Yeah, we'll all have a good time. It is one of the, I think if I had to list, maybe the top 25, my top 25 favorite pieces of all time, this would be one of them.
Me too. And so would a lot of other people as well.
Yeah.
But so now let's talk about the Pops series that comes up next. The title titled Heroes and Villains.
Heroes and Villains, and more particularly Heroes and Villains of film music. Right?
Yes.
Movie music. To be truthful, it's more of an excuse just to do great film music and put a title on it. But you don't have to go too far to find great symphonic film music that is written about heroes, various different heroes. And you don't have to, you have to go a little bit farther. You have to search a little bit more to find music written about villains. Because, it's more fun to write about heroes, isn't it? But there are some villains out there. For instance, we were talking earlier about James Bond.
Mm-hmm.
Aside from the 007 theme, virtually all of the music written for the James Bond movies has been about a villain. Goldfinger, they're all about
Jaws.
Jaws. Well, not that Jaws.
No, but that was the character
Jaws.
Jaws.
Right.
Yeah.
So it'll be an excuse to do a concert of great symphonic music. One of the pieces I want to do on that is Robin Hood. Mm-hmm. By Korngold.
Yes.
One of the Robin Hood, one of the great, great film scores of all time. So that's going to be a fun, fun concert to put together.
So what about the Classic Six program? And what felt like it needed to be the repertoire for your final concert?
This is probably the hardest one to put together in a way because, you only have one chance to do a last concert. Unless you do a retirement tour every year. For
yeah, reunion tour, like the rock bands,
right,
you know?
Yeah. So, where do you start on this? Well, we haven't done Strauss's Don Juan for probably 15 years or something like that. I think we've only done it once. It's a tremendously difficult piece. As you know, every single orchestral audition for a string player will have a page or two at least of Don Juan.
So they've already practiced it.
Yeah, right. that's a real big help. Everybody knows this piece very, very well. But it's one of the great late romantic scores, greatest ever written. Strauss's first big hit, I think, if I remember correctly. A piece that's great fun to conduct, challenges the orchestra very much, and it's glorious to listen to.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a good way to kick off the program. After that, come back to a piece that I've done a couple of times, actually three times, one with narration in Spanish, a piece by Dan Welcher called Haleakala, or How Maui Snared the Sun. And it's a piece for narrator and orchestra. I don't know, anybody remember when we did this? You do. Okay. Remember the exotic Hawaiian percussion instruments called for in there?
Up to Jurassic Park, it was the largest percussion setup in 37 years.
Did we use a jawbone on that one, too?
No jawbone. There is a conch shell.
Oh, okay.
It opens with somebody in the brass section playing a conch shell. This is the idea. The Polynesian legend is that Maui, who is the namesake of the island, the Hawaiian island, solved the problem. The sun was going by too fast to allow the crops to mature. So his task was to go up to the top of Haleakala, the extinct volcano, and to snare the sun and to force the sun to go more slowly. And therefore having a growing season that you could grow crops on. So it's a very well written, very exotic sounding piece, but lots of fun to listen to and lots of fun to play.
Mm-hmm. Sounds very colorful.
It is.
Yeah. And then we have the Shostakovich Fifth Symphony.
Yes, Shostakovich Fifth Symphony. This is a piece that I already decided a long time ago I had to finish with. It's been a very important piece to me for a long time. I studied conducting in the Netherlands with Kirill Kondrashin, who at the time was a Soviet composer, and about 4 days after I came back to the United States, defected and became a Russian composer back in the years of the Soviet Union. And this is one of the pieces we had studied I had conducted this piece under his supervision. It was, although we couldn't communicate very fluently at the time, his English was not very good, was pretty much non-existent at this point.
Mm-hmm.
But it was very obvious from the translation and from talking to him, from dealing with him, that this was something that the Russians, like him, felt very, very strongly was a strong protest against Joseph Stalin. Mm-hmm. And was, as a matter of fact, it was, in a way, was Shostakovich's, it was his last-ditch effort to avoid getting either deported to the gulags or worse, having run afoul of Stalin in 1937. And an expression of his pain at suffering this kind of repression in the Soviet Union, and in some respects a kind of a coded message of defiance. And it meant something very much, very, very strongly, very deeply to him, and it came to mean something very deeply to me, too. It's a piece I know very well, and resonates very deeply within me. And I thought, this is probably the piece I want to go out with.
No, it's great, a great piece of expression of triumph, I think, in that piece. And the coded messages are interesting in that this is something that he was presenting as a Soviet piece that was going to be...
One of Stalin's things is that he thought that socialist realism, you should be happy, and you should write pieces in major keys. Mm-hmm. Well, that's certainly not true of the first movement and the third movement, and a good chunk of the second movement, for that matter, or for most of the fourth movement. Mm-hmm. But he does end in D major at the end. But he ends in D major in a way that... this is my own interpretation. He wrote this knowing that Stalin would probably think, this is great, I love this. And he would have no idea how absolutely crass this music really is.
Right. It's still a great piece of music, yeah. No matter what you know about its background.
Right, yeah.
So as we wrap up here, I want to ask you, what's next for you? What happens after this?
I don't know. I really don't know. We're probably going to travel as much as we can, as much as scheduling, particularly my wife's schedule, permits. I already told her I was going to take care of cleaning the house. But I don't know. We've been thinking about doing volunteer work for Habitat for Humanity, for instance.
No ladders.
No. No matter, so.
I really don't know. I'm going to wait and see what happens when I get there. I've always also joked that I'd like to work in the plumbing department at Home Depot. Mm-hmm. That seems like fun.
Until you do it.
Good luck.
Thanks for listening, and I hope you're as excited as I am about the 2021 season. Subscriptions are on sale now and can be purchased online at rockfordsymphony.com. Until next time!